Okay, so. So we haven't talked much about really groupware stuff yet, because all we talked about was having stuff going on in the client, how to build a HTTP server with Node. And an HTTP server, all it does, it serves pages, whether they are predefined or computed on the fly. You can have forms, but forms is not really going to get you very far in terms of interactivity and real-time editing and things like this. So that's where socket.io comes in. Now, for a while now, the web browsers have had the ability to communicate with the server, not only over to do page requests, but also with plain sockets, so that within the page, you can open a connection to the client and have stuff going back and forth with a regular socket connection. So this is not, I don't know if any of you knows about AJAX. So AJAX is a way to do an HTTP request inside the browser to call a piece of information from the browser inside the page without refreshing the page. But it means that it is the client that has to initiate the call. Now, if you imagine doing a chat system, someone is going to type something and click send. That goes to the server, but then the server needs to send that information to all the other clients, and the other clients don't know that it's coming. So they kind of be the ones who initiate the connection to the server to say, you know, give me the next piece. So with the socket connection, the basic thing in the modern browsers is called WebSockets. Socket.io is something on top of WebSockets. With WebSockets or Socket.io, I can establish a connection with the server and then have data go back and forth from each party. So the way this is done is fairly easy. First, you need to install the module called Socket.io. Then you need to require that module from your program. And you need to have an HTTP server created with the either Express or something else. And the way the WebSocket protocol works is that it is actually using the existing connection of the HTTP server. That's why you need to have an HTTP server so your WebSocket can run on top of it. So it doesn't matter why you have to do this. It just works. Then you get I/O, which is the module that will... which is really the representing the server. And here we see again this event-based behavior where creating the server with the require call here takes time. So the connection, the server is not ready immediately, so you can wait until it's ready with a on call, but here what I'm waiting for is when someone connects, because this is really what's interesting. The server is sitting there doing nothing, and at some point someone is going to connect. So on connection, I call the function here, the callback, and this function is being given a socket, the socket connecting to that particular client. So I've decided to call it client here. And so essentially, once I have a connection, the things I do is I say, well, if the client sends me a message of type MSG, I will do this. If it sends me a message, say, of type hello, for example, or something else, I will react to it. And then the other thing I can do is also listen when the client disconnects to shut things down properly. So now, here again, if we are in this basic example of a chat room, clients will send, every time someone types something, that client, well, web page in the browser really, will send to the server a message with data, those things that has been typed, And what the server wants to do is to send this to all the other clients connected. That's the base functionality of a chat room. So if you use this call, client.broadcast.emit, it is emitting the event MSG with the data here to all the other clients connected to that server. And all other is what this broadcast means. If you want to send a message to everybody, including the one that sent it in the first place, sometimes you want to tell everybody something, then instead of client.broadcast, you just use io.emit. So io.emit emit to all the clients. Client.broadcast.emit emits to all the clients except the client itself. Right? So that's essentially the bulk of the server side of a chat system. And if I can get my cursor here, come on. Where are you? Here. Now, what's happening on the client side? Yes. Sorry.
Just the client object is in the socket.io package, or
the client is passed as a parameter into the callback.
Oh, okay.
So what's happening on the in the web page where you have your interface to the chat system? Well, you need to include the socket.io client side library that does, you know, the stuff above the native WebSocket stuff. And in the simple case, you will get this from the server that has served that page, the client page, so you just get this. And it's kind of similar on the client side. You create a client with simply a call to IO. This socket.io.js will define an object called IO. You just call IO, which opens a connection to the server. Now, there can be extra parameters to IO, but I'm doing the simplest possible thing here. So client is therefore a socket, a connection to the server. And again, when I do this, the connection is not going to happen instantly. It takes time to establish the connection. So I want to be notified when I'm connected. So client.onConnect will be called when the connection is actually established. There is also other messages if the connection fails, so you can be told that it didn't work. So here, when I get the connection, I'm going to emit a message saying hello. So this will send the message to the server. The message tag is MSG. So on the server side, it will go into that handler, and therefore it will say hello to everybody else. And then, going back to the client side, when I receive a message of type MSG, well, all I want to do is put it somewhere on the web page. So here I'm using a little bit of jQuery. I assume I have, I don't know, a paragraph or a list in my object called the chat, and I'm just appending the message to the chat. What's it called? Element in my DOM object. Does this make sense? It's a piece of jQuery just saying, you know, add this to the web page. So that's all it takes to have a basic chat system and to have real-time communication between several clients and the server. Of course, in a real system, you will have different messages. Here, I use the same message for everything, but maybe hello. In fact, in the demo I'll give, I have a message called hello, and the data is the name of the person. And you sort of create your own protocol in this way. The very nice feature of Socket.io is that it deals with disconnection and automatic reconnection. So you can have your page running here. I can kill the server. It will say, it will, if you put a handler on disconnect, it will tell you, oops, we're disconnected. But in fact, by default, it will try to reconnect every few seconds. And when it reconnects, it notifies you and where you are. And for anybody who's programmed stuff in distributed systems, this business of things being disconnected and reconnecting is always pure hell. So here it works really pretty nicely. Okay, so once you have this, you can implement essentially everything we've talked about, including things like operational transform and other things based on this facility of having channels open between each client and the server. But there are a number of libraries that can help you. So one of them is ShareJS. So ShareJS was created by someone who was at Google, was involved in the Wave, Google Wave project, which died. But in fact, Google Docs today sort of came out of that. But this guy left Google and decided to take the operational transform implementation they had done in Google Wave and turn it into a standalone library that everybody could use. And so it's called ShareJS. Now, it's still experimental. In fact, I was looking at it yesterday, and you need to install quite a number of things to make it work, so I actually didn't do it. But I have a colleague who is using it, and it does work. In the simplest version, you create a text area, a text input area in your web page, and you tell ShareJS, well, this is the text that I want to synchronize with all the other clients. And essentially, that's pretty much all you have to do here to implement this. We'll see the demo they have on their website. So if you want to use ShareJS, it's not that easy because it needs to have a database to store all the log of operations. And it wants a database so that if you shut down the server and you come back, well, the documents are still there, so you need some form of persistence. And they use MongoDB, but they have other modules. And when I played with it last year, it was still one module you install, and that was it. Now they've broken it down into several pieces, and I found it a little bit too complicated. Now, the other thing is that it's not limited to editing text. You can actually do operational transform to synchronize JSON objects, so arbitrary objects, collection of properties nested at arbitrary levels, can also be synchronized between clients in a robust way using operational transform on tree structures as opposed as text, where it's a linear structure. Okay, another tool that you may find useful is called Dnode. The idea with Dnode was to give the user the access to the abstraction of remote procedure call. Because when you program distributed things with Socket.io, well, you send messages back and forth. But imagine you want to... well, in the context of a chat system, it's maybe not a good example, but maybe you want, I don't know the list of users or something where you need to send a message to the server and the server to respond to you. Now, with the abstractions we've seen so far in Socket.io, you need to have to send the message, and then the answer is going to come back later. And so it's not, you know, you need to be able to correlate the answer with the original message and things like this. It would be nicer if you could make it as if you're calling a function, because that's the way we're used to program things, except the function is implemented in the server. So in the client, you call the function, but the function is actually implemented in the server, but it looks like calling a function. So with Dnode, you can do that. On the server side, you're going to create a set of functions that will have names, like here I've used the list files. So imagine you have your browser window, and you need to know the list of files that you have in the server. So the server, assuming it's implemented in Node, has access to the current directory. So you declare a function list files here that takes, well, it should be s, it should be path, the path where you want to list the files, and here the function what is that? Yeah, so list files is going to be called with a path that you want to list, and the callback is the way to send the answer, the result. So here I'm going to call the callback cb with a list of files. Now, to compute the list of files, I'm using read directory, which is a feature of the file system module of Dnode. So I told the of Node, sorry, I tell Node, well, read that path, and when you're done, call this function with the array listing all the files. And once this is done, I just call this callback here to send the files back to the client. And you see we have two levels of asynchrony here. One is the client is calling me and doesn't know when I will respond. And on the server side, to implement this call, I need to do an asynchronous call to read directory, which may take whatever time it takes. Now, you run the server. On the client side, once you've established the connection and all that, essentially, when the remote connection is established, this event is called. So this is essentially your main program. You have a link to the server called the remote here. That's like the client earlier. But the interesting thing is that it's defined this list files as if it were a function of this remote object executed locally. But in fact, when you call list files, it will send a message to the server. And when the server sends the response back, it will invoke this callback here, so you can actually do something with the result. Again, I have the sense I've made this more complicated, sound more complicated than it is. But essentially, on the server side, you write the functions you want to have accessible remotely as a list here. Each has a callback to send the result. And on the client side, when you want to invoke a function of the server, you do remote dot one of the functions you have defined.
Are there some security implications for just accepting callbacks as, random functions from clients?
Well, here you assume that the connection is established over a secure link. I mean, you can only talk to the I don't know in the case of Dnode actually. Well, I would say it's a good question. Read the documentation. I don't know, but usually all of this stuff, it's recommended to operate over secure connection HTTPS. The server is doing whatever it does. What it sends back is an object. It's up to the client to be careful.
Well, then it's like if your callback function that the client gave you contains some malicious code.
You're not executing code that is sent by the client. I mean, it's up to the server to not do that.
Oh, you're sending back the function.
Here, what you're just sending is the name list files.
Oh, it's
on this.
Right.
Here we're in the client. And on the server, well, it's up to you to be careful with the data that the client is sending you.
The server's not actually executing the callback?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay, another tool, which is a favorite of mine at the moment. This is a system that was created so people could use the web technologies, all the HTML, CSS stuff, to create desktop applications. Now, what you have in the web environment, in a web browser, in fact, it's a good segue, because a lot of the effort currently to develop the web is around security. And more now, there are things that used to be possible that have become impossible. So it's already impossible for the browser to access your file system. And even if you are running something, a server locally, you cannot do everything. There's a lot of protections in place for good reasons. Now, when you write a desktop application, something that you want to look like a desktop application, you don't want to have all the limitations, things like the cross origin, the same origin, all this security stuff. So NodeWebKit is essentially the welding together of a Node server and a web browser where all the securities have been disabled, so that you can have access from within the web browser, from within the page, you have access to all the modules from Node, including the file system. So with that, I can write, do I have an example here? Yes, I can write a script in my page that actually uses require from Node. I can require the module file system, I can read the directory, and I can list the list of files like this inside my web page. So now, it may not be very useful for the kind of projects you're trying to do, but you can actually do groupware with this, because you can have one NodeWebKit instance communicate to a Node server, and the Node server communicate with multiple NodeWebKit instances. So it's just a way to me, the best way to think of this is to separate what is the management of content in the web environment, the web page, and where the content of the page comes from all the infrastructure of the web in terms of web HTTP servers and proxies and the cache and all that, which is very good for a number of things. But for some applications, you want sort of more direct control over your protocol with the servers. So it's very nice to be able to program web pages with direct access to all the Node modules. And it's something we're using in our research currently for doing weird things. So I'm laughing because Niyadi is working with us on a project where we're using NodeWebKit for a world-size environment. So we're running NodeWebKit on each of the screen of our wall display. And we are also running it on the front-end computer. With that, we can actually do things like displaying a web page on the entire wall by having each WebKit client showing a piece of the web page and doing the illusion that you have a web browser that is the size of the wall. And yet he's working on a project where, in fact, we're even using this to talk to another application that is not web-based at all. So it's just that you can start doing things that are unusual. Now, a little bit of the downsides of programming in things like JavaScript is that you have to do a lot of debugging. As I said, there's no typing, so many obvious errors are not going to be caught until you run the program. And more than that, because JavaScript was designed to be quite lenient, the place where the error will show up can be quite distant from where it actually originated. So what tools do you have? Well, when you are in the browser, you have the developer tools in the browser. This is the one from Safari, but you have also very good ones in Firefox and in Chrome. So it's worth really taking some time to understand how to use these developer tools. There are various tabs here that lets you see the HTML, that lets you see the resources in the network, that is how your web browser is talked to the server to get all the images and all the bits and pieces. You have access to the JavaScript source code, like here. You can, if you profile your code, you can see the timeline of things happening, and you have the console where you can actually type JavaScript interactively to explore your objects. You have a debugger where you can set breakpoints. You can see the call stack that we see here, all the functions, what has called what. You can put breakpoints, you can explore things. It's quite a powerful environment. And there are tools that automatically instrument your code to make it easier to see the traces, for example, of what it's doing. There are very good tutorials online to learn how to use the debuggers. And since there are different between Safari, well, they are similar but different between Safari and Firefox and Chrome, I didn't want to go into more details. Now, this is all nice and well, but if you are writing Node.js code, you don't have a browser there for the server side of things. Well, so there is a built-in debugger in Node, actually, but it's pretty crude. But you can call Node debug your script. And then you can, if you want to break at a certain point, you call debugger in your code, and it will stop there, and you can do some basic exploration of the variables, call stack, and all that. But that's kind of a little bit limited. Now, the thing is, because there's such a good debugger in web browsers, and in fact, the way the developer tools, and particularly the debugger, work in the browser is through a well-known protocol between the developer tools and the page that is running the code, and the V8 engine that is, well, the JavaScript engine executing it. So in fact, what you can do is install a module through npm called the Node Inspector. You have to install it globally, and you have to omit this parenthesis here. Then you're going to run your Node script in this debug mode. Then you run Node Inspector in the background, and then a miracle happens. If you go to a URL like this on your browser, you will have the developer tools to debug your Node code from the browser. And, well, the reason of the magic is because, in fact, Node and Node Inspector here implement the same protocol that is being used by the developer tools when they debug the... it's also the reason why, if you've developed stuff on Android or iOS, web, if you run, I don't know for Android, but I know for Safari, on iOS, you can run Safari on iOS and actually run the developer tools, open the developer tools on your desktop computer to debug the stuff running on the mobile, which is good because if you had the developer tools inside your iPhone, you wouldn't see much of what's going on. So that's a very good way to do debugging. And then there are IDEs, integrated development environments. The ones for JavaScript are still in their infancy, I would say. The one I found is the best, at least the best value for money, is called WebStorm. It's done by JetBrains. And JetBrains, you may know, they do IDEs for Java. They're apart from Eclipse, they're the top IDE for Java. So their IDE is developed in Java, and they have a version for JavaScript called WebStorm. You can download it and have a month free. And then I think it's not that expensive. So it's the usual type of IDE. So you have a text editor that does syntax coloring and that does real-time analysis of the code, so it can flag some likely errors. It has also what's called templates for language constructs and things like this. There is a notion of a project where you can put all your things together. You can run, so the debugger here is integrated in the environment, and so you can run the debugger and do all the things you do, and it knows about things like Node. It knows about things like running your page in the browser, so you can open your page in the browser you've specified and sort of debug it remotely. And the editor has supports multiple cursors, which is something that is really cool. And there was one more thing. And it even supports languages that translate to JavaScript, like TypeScript and CoffeeScript. So if you've installed the add-on and you write in TypeScript, it will compile it into JavaScript automatically in the background, so you don't even realize this is happening. I've started using it just a few days ago, and I'm quite pleasantly surprised, I must say. The learning curve is a little bit steep as with all of these things. And last bit, the near future, which is already here, but it's called WebRTC. So there's a big effort going on. Mostly, I mean, Google is very active in this area, but the other vendors are participating as well. WebRTC stands for real-time communication. And the idea is to have an infrastructure here to support real-time communication between peers, between clients, without necessarily going through a server. So this is different, even though it builds on things like WebSockets and stuff, other stuff I talked about. With WebSockets, typically your clients talk to the same server. Now, if you want to do the equivalent of, I was going to say Skype, but I should say Google Hangout, because that runs in the browser. So if you want to do real-time video conferencing or audio conferencing, it's silly to go through a server from, you know, client one to server to client two. Well, if you have more than two people, maybe it makes sense, but most cases it's peer-to-peer. So WebRTC allows you to first get access to hardware on your computer, such as the camera, the microphone, to capture input. Lets you establish connections between peers, even if they are behind firewalls and things like this. And then have audio, video, and data flow between those peers, so client to client. The thing that I also find interesting is that this is all built on top of a stack that is implemented in C++. So in fact, there are also a number of libraries that talk WebRTC, but with native APIs that don't require you to be in the web. So you could do a desktop application that uses those APIs, but it means that using the same protocols used by the web API, you can interoperate between a desktop application and the web-based application. So it's, I would say, the APIs are still complex. It's still quite unstable. It's only really running on Chrome and somehow Firefox and also Opera, but it's really Chrome that is ahead of the curve here. But it's doing pretty cool stuff, especially for audio and video, because it's the first time you can really do real-time audio and video in the browser without a plugin in the browser. Okay, and I think that's it. So I will give quick demos of various things I've talked about. I would like to spend a few minutes after that to think about projects you may want to do. Now, the point here is not for you to be necessarily creative. The point for me in this project is that you get to understand what it takes to implement some of the aspects of a groupware system. So I also don't want you to just download a chat system from the web and say it's my project. So as I said, I don't care really what tool you're using, whether it's Java. Last year, a bunch of projects were done in Java. There are really good libraries to do that in Java as well. Web stuff or something else, I don't care. Try to think in advance of what you need to implement it, because you want to look at the libraries that are available and the tools that are available. So, I'm not looking for things beyond shared drawing tools or shared browsing or shared annotation of a web page or reasonably well-done multi-room chat or some other, The goal is for you to get the experience of what it is to build such a system. So I suggest I go to quickly through the demos I have here. So I'm going to stop this. And I'm going to do something I've never done before, which is to do a recording of the screen. I wanted to fix the bug here. We saw there was a...
Okay. Can I ask you something?
Yes.
Why in this project we have to make always our hands dirty with programming, etc.? I mean, we are in an HCI project, and sometimes I don't feel like we are in an HCI project. I feel like we are in the more computer science only programmers, etc. It's not so creative sometimes. I don't know.
Well, the answer is in your question, is in the sometimes. So I strongly believe that even as a designer, first, I think HCI is really both design and engineering and design and computer science. And I think that in the same way as it's important for the people with a computer science background and training and more the engineering side to learn about design, even though they may never have to be designers, I think it's important for designers to also understand the tools and how things work, because I think it also affects the way you design things. But I'm aware that you have different backgrounds, and we try to take this into account when we grade, and I don't expect as much as someone who doesn't have the same programming skills as someone else. But I think it's important to understand a little bit how these things work to get a sense of the type of delay that you get when you do this kind of interaction, because I think it affects the way you do design work as well.
But do you think that the design part is reflected in our project and also the evaluation part? For example, in one of our projects we had an evaluation part with real users and etc. Just in
well,
master thesis maybe?
Yeah, so... That's a good question, and it's something that we're fixing starting next year, which of course you don't care because you won't be here. But when we designed this program, we had to do with the teaching skills we had as well, and make a program that was consistent with what the people around here are doing. And so the students who are in the Master 1, they have a full evaluation module. And what we're doing next year, starting next year, is that this will be actually available to the M2 students as well. So we've reorganized the program. I mean, you did some evaluation in Wendy's class.
Yeah, but it was just 1 week, 5 days. We just did very fast things.
Yeah,
and it doesn't have evaluated with evaluation with users.
Yeah, but I'll tell you that this is things we have tried to do, and we don't know how to do it in class. It's just incredibly heavy to do. I mean, how the master one students taking a class on evaluation, where they actually do an evaluation using a system we've built to, but it's a specific type of evaluation, controlled lab experiment. It's not a usability study. It's not a walkthrough. It's not, etc. So we tried to do this, but it's really complicated. And the class that Wendy does, she wanted to do a bootcamp type of thing, because before we've done this with one session a week, and there were other problems with that. So we try things, and we try to learn what doesn't work and improve it. So that's why also we need this kind of feedback. So I, having said that, we are in a computer science department, so yes, the bias is more towards computer science. There's no question about it. I would like to have more design. This year we were able to, again, we did it only at the M1 level because we were starting this year, but we had a course on creative design, a course on digital fabrication with the Fab Lab. Starting next year, this will be accessible to the M2 students as well. And we're trying to do more of that, but we also don't have the people to teach that stuff. For creative design, for example, we had a postdoc, Laura, who had the right training to do this. And we've tried to find people outside, but 1 year they can do it, the next year they can't. So it's tricky. We don't have people who have what I think. I mean, we are designers to some extent, but I don't feel like I can teach about this stuff.
But also, for example, in the most of your things that you have to do in your research, you have a part that's the evaluation part. And
yeah.
I feel like, because yesterday, or the day before, I don't remember, in the presentation of HCI, I also felt like, okay, we implement something. Because we thought that this is a good decision. We thought this is a nice design or something.
But
all of these things is just for the present. I mean, like,
I think really for the, I mean, I agree with you. The thing is, you see that the program is already pretty full, and then it's a question of making the right choices. It's also the question of the number of students, because if we add more electives, we still have this bar that we need 10 students per elective. I absolutely agree that we should have the course on evaluation part of this. At some point, it was part of my class, but I moved it when we changed some things, and Wendy was covering some of it. But it's true that the bootstrap format has some advantages and some drawbacks, and the drawback is they don't have enough time to iterate things from one session to the next. So yeah, well, we are aware of these things. I don't have, you know, the right answers maybe, but we are aware that this is.
But I just thought all these things for a lot of time, and I was like.
No, but the evaluation part. If you do an internship in a research lab, you're very likely to have to do it there and to be trained there, because doing a real evaluation is really hard. You need to find users, and evaluating things on each other's is problems. So. It's really a tricky issue. Okay?